JFF Jeffersonville. Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a victory for voting rights groups. Pennsylvania mail ballots cannot be rejected over a missing date. The state court says that, quote, disenfranchising citizens over inconsequential paperwork errors violates voting rights. Republicans will appeal the decision in a case brought by civil rights groups, setting up a clash at the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court. We'll learn more from Vote Beat Pennsylvania reporter Carter Walker. Catskills Couture. Emily Lee Mandry, founder of the women's accessory brand MLE in Ulster County, talks about the challenges and rewards of running a fashion brand in upstate New York from the Catscast podcast, plus Zane Grey Plein Air's group show, So Falls, Skinner Falls. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. A Russian strike on a city in central Ukraine has killed at least 41 people today, according to Ukrainian authorities. Another 180 others are injured. NPR's Joanna Kikissis reports from Kyiv. Emergency workers say many people are still trapped under rubble.
Two ballistic missiles struck a military training institute and a nearby hospital in Poltava, a quiet city that is far from the front line. Ukraine's defense ministry said that those evacuating did not have time to reach the bomb shelter. In a video message, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky urged his country's allies to stop delaying the delivery of air defense systems. He also repeated his plea to let Ukraine use long-range weapons to strike military targets in Russia. Long-range strikes that can protect us from Russian terror are needed now, not later, Zelensky said. Every day of delay means more lost lives. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
President Biden is focusing on the job market this week as he holds a series of events across swing states. As NPR's Jimena Bustillo reports, Biden appeared yesterday with Vice President Harris.
President Biden spent his Labor Day afternoon campaigning alongside Vice President Kamala Harris at a union hall in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Wall Street did not build America. The middle class built America, and unions built the middle class.
Now, to continue his focus on economic development, the president will take to Michigan and Wisconsin this week. The White House is calling this Biden's Investing in America content series. It will also take place in three swing states that are among those that Harris needs to win in order to stay in the White House this November. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
Former President Donald Trump did not hold events on Labor Day. He will join supporters later today in Georgia at an event outside of Atlanta. Stocks opened lower at the start of this holiday-shortened trading week. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 400 points, or nearly 1%, in early trading.
Stock in U.S. Steel opened lower after Vice President Kamala Harris said she's opposed to the company's planned sale to Japan's Nippon Steel. Harris was speaking at a Labor Day rally in Pennsylvania. President Biden and former President Donald Trump have also come out against the steel deal, which is scheduled to close later this year. Analysts at Wells Fargo have downgraded Boeing stock in anticipation of a possible machinist strike. The jetmaker's contract with the machinist union is set to expire in less than 10 days. Later this week, the Labor Department will offer an update on the U.S. job market. The Federal Reserve is keeping a close eye on the labor market as it decides how much to cut interest rates later this month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 450 points. This is NPR. Automaker Volkswagen is reportedly considering closing at least two of its plants in its home country of Germany. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from Berlin.
Volkswagen is Germany's largest industrial employer, but the automaker has lost nearly a third of its value over the past 5 years as it struggles to make the transition to electric vehicles while high-performing affordable Chinese imports are beginning to dominate the global market. VW management has reportedly identified plants in Osnabrück and in Dresden, which together employ more than 2,000 workers, to potentially shut down. VW executives are scheduled to speak to staff at a meeting on Wednesday. Opposition politician Friedrich Merz blames the current German government and its push for electric vehicles for VW's situation, saying Germany's economy is losing its competitiveness. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
Meanwhile, the former boss of Volkswagen AG is going on trial today in Germany. Martin Winterkorn is accused of fraud. This is in connection with what's called Dieselgate. That's when VW installed defeat devices on some of its vehicles that allowed these to cheat on emissions testing. Competitive eater Joey Chestnut has set a new world record for hot dog eating in the highly anticipated rematch with his longtime rival Takeru Kobayashi. Chestnut swallowed 83 hot dogs in 10 minutes. Kobayashi set his own personal record of 66 hot dogs. Their chowdown was the subject of Netflix's live-streamed special Unfinished Beef yesterday from Las Vegas. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Not counting a voter's mail ballot because they failed to properly date the return envelope violates their rights under the state constitution, a Pennsylvania appellate court ruled on Friday. Republicans said they would immediately appeal the ruling to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, but if the decision stands, it could affect thousands of ballots and influence the outcome of close races in the crucial swing state. Carter Walker is reporter for VoteBeat Pennsylvania, the nonpartisan local reporting group on elections and voting, and joins us now. He broke the story as it came out Friday. And Carter, this is a victory for voting rights groups.
Definitely a victory for voting rights groups. This is the goal that they had in mind when they brought this case earlier this year. So definitely a victory for them.
Let's remind folks what this case was all about. It centered around something called Act 77. Explain to folks what Act 77 is or does.
Yeah, so Act 77, it was passed in 2019. And it is the law in Pennsylvania that enabled voters to vote by mail regardless of whether or not they had an excuse. Previously, voters could only cast a mail ballot if they had some reason that they couldn't go to their polls on election day, like they were sick or going to be out of county. But then when Act 77 passed, anybody could vote by mail. The part of the law that issue here is one that we talked a lot about, whether or not when voters return those ballots, they need to sign and date the envelope, particularly the dating requirement. Both in absentee voting and in mail ballot voting, there's a line in the law that says voters have to sign and date the ballot, but that dating provision has been contentious because under previous cases, the ACLU and others have argued that violates the 1964 Civil Rights Act and a provision in there. But that has had mixed results in federal court, and most recently was shot down by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. So earlier this year, they brought a new challenge to the dating requirement under the state constitution, which has much stronger language on voters' rights.
So, yeah, they've gone back and forth at the federal level, but is this the first case that directly challenges this requirement under the state constitution?
That's right, yeah. Previously, there in some of these cases over the years, there's been references and allusions to the free and equal elections clause under the state constitution, and that maybe if a plaintiff brought a case under that clause, it would be more successful than what they were trying with the materiality provision. But nobody had tried that yet. Unlike your listeners might not know, but the U.S. Constitution actually doesn't have an affirmative right to vote. It says you can't deny a person the right to vote for certain reasons, but doesn't say you affirmatively have the right to vote. But state constitutions are different. A lot of state constitutions do have affirmative rights to vote, which makes voter protections much stronger at the state level. Pennsylvania has one of those in our constitution. It's called the Free and Equal Elections Clause. And so the ACLU and the Public Interest Legal Center, on behalf of their clients, brought this challenge under that clause, thinking that affirmative language would make their case that the dating requirement was superfluous much stronger.
And so the suit named two of the state's largest counties and the Pennsylvania Department of State as defendants, but the Department of State declined to defend the requirement. What did they say?
That's right. The Department of State, in the various cases throughout the years, hasn't defended this portion of the law, even though, you know, they might theoretically be the one who's supposed to be enforcing it, and they do in the instructions that they give to counties. But they're not in favor of this dating requirement. They think that it disenfranchises voters for no good reason. You know, they point to the fact that, as do all the counties as well, point to the fact that this date on the envelope is not really used in election administration when ballots are sent out. The county records the time electronically in our ballot tracking system of when it is sent out. And then there's a barcode on the envelope that is rescanned when the ballot comes back in. So counties already know when the ballot was sent out and when it was received. So the date isn't what's being used to determine if the ballot was received in time. It has to be received by election day. So the Department of State has not defended this provision. They have argued against it, saying, yes, this is superfluous, and we feel it violates voters' rights and voters', you know, ability to cast a ballot. So they were actually on the other side of the case this time.
So it's a 5-judge Commonwealth Court there in Pennsylvania. What was the vote split? And then what did the majority opinion say? I mean, they called it meaningless paperwork error, right?
Right, right. We have actually 9 judges, I believe it's 9, on our Commonwealth Court. And so this was a 5-judge panel of the court, which is important, and I'll get to in a second. Mm-hmm. 4 of those judges, like you said, agreed with the ACLU and the Public Interest Legal Center's argument that this requirement was superfluous, that it was voters shouldn't be disenfranchised for meaningless paperwork errors, like you had said, and they enjoined the county. They say they told the counties Philadelphia and Allegheny, which is home to Pittsburgh, as well as the Department of State. They said you can't enforce this anymore. You can't reject ballots just because they don't have this date. There was one judge dissenting who didn't agree with that line of argument. She thought the legislature had clear right to put these restrictions on voting, you know, if they felt that that was what was necessary to protect it. So that left us with a 4-1 split, which is important because for a decision to technically set legal precedent, it has to have a majority of the court. So we only have 4 out of 9 judges there, but that's a little besides the point now since it's been appealed up to the state Supreme Court where a decision will set precedent.
And will this apply statewide? Because it was directed for the Department of State and the suit named the 2 largest counties in Philadelphia and Allegheny counties.
Right. Yeah. Like I had spoken to some of the lawyers involved in the case and some of the others because I was a little unclear on that as well, since it, like I explained, didn't technically set legal precedent. And the way that they had explained it to me is, well, it has different meanings for each of the counties. For the 2 counties that were named in the suit, you know, there's a specific injunction against them from rejecting ballots on this basis. There'd be penalties brought against them. But that, beside the point, all counties now are on notice that the Commonwealth Court, this is their opinion on the matter. So if a county were to go and disenfranchise a voter for this reason, they would be doing so despite a court ruling saying that they shouldn't do that. So it should apply to all counties. But like I said, it's been appealed now just last night, actually. And so it will, whatever decision we reach at state Supreme Court will apply statewide.
Right. So will we expect that Supreme Court decision before November? I'm assuming we will.
Most definitely. In fact, the court last week issued a temporary order that speeds up a lot of the timelines for election court cases. It appears that they got the message over the last couple of years that election administrators and I think political parties and candidates too weren't really happy with the way the court had been releasing their decisions. They had there had been a lot of times where court cases were holding up administrative functions of elections, like getting names on the ballot, or court cases were coming down in the time period when we're counting ballots and perhaps changing the rules on what ballots should be counted. So last week they issued an order suspending some of the timelines, tightening up some other timelines so that these cases will get resolved in a much quicker manner. And we're already seeing that happen. This decision in the Commonwealth Court came down on Friday. The Commonwealth Court is one step below the Supreme Court. And the new timeline for these cases said that even if it's over a weekend, you only have 3 days to appeal these decisions, which is why we saw an appeal on Monday, which, you know, that's very quick. That was only 3 days. Now the briefs in that case are due within 24 hours, so today. So yeah, we're definitely going to get on this before November.
And on a holiday, no less. So if you're just joining us, we're speaking to Carter Walker of Vote Beat PA. That is the nonpartisan newsroom reporting on elections and voting in Pennsylvania. We're talking about this ruling on Friday that mail ballots can't be rejected over improper dates on the envelope. The Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court ruled that. As we're discussing, it's being appealed to the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. And this is interesting, I thought, that it's not just the Pennsylvania GOP, but also the Republican National Committee has intervened in the case as well.
That's right. Yeah, they, since the Department of State, you know, declined, and the counties as well, declined to defend their practice of not counting ballots with missing dates, the GOP and the RNC, in this litigation and in the other cases over the years, they have intervened as the primary defendant person pushing to keep this requirement. So they're who appealed yesterday. They argue that these dates, even if they are not used to determine that the ballot was received on time, they argue it could have other benefits, like being a backstop should our electronic ballot tracking system ever fail, or being used by prosecutors to help prove fraud, like if somebody votes the ballot of a dead voter and they put the date on the ballot that is passed when that person has died. That's the argument that they've been making in these cases. Judges haven't been particularly convinced by that, but that has been their defense to it. You know, I think the reason that politically that they would want to intervene in this case is we still see 4 years later that mail ballots skew heavily Democrat. So eliminating any number of mail ballots is likely, as a matter of percentage, to benefit Republicans.
So the ruling will have a wide impact in the general election. Can you talk a little bit about, like, the amount of ballots that come through, or what that looks like?
Yeah, definitely. So in the most recent time that we have data from is the primary, obviously. And during the primary, roughly 8,500 ballots were rejected for what we call fatal defects. So that's not having a proper date, not being signed, or not being placed inside a secrecy envelope before the voter puts it in the return envelope. So for those three reasons, about 8,500 ballots were rejected during the primary, and 4,400 of those were for having an improper date or no date at all. So that's about that works out to about 0.58% of all mail ballots. Now, I've done some back of the napkin math here, so take it with a grain of salt, but I was trying to get a sense for myself of what that would mean come the November election. We had something like 2.6 million mail ballots in 2020. You know, I expect that to be lower since it's not a pandemic. There's also been some changes to the mail ballot envelope that, should this data requirement stay in place, will probably still save some other mail ballots. But with all that said, you know, I'm picturing that this could save or endanger, depending on how the decision comes down, about 10,000 ballots, which could be enough to sway some state races, particularly with how close things are looking in PA this year.
Yeah, definitely a crucial swing state. I want to take a break here and talk to you about a couple of other court cases that could determine how Pennsylvania handles mail ballots this fall. It's not just this date requirement. There are a couple of other disputes involving provisional ballots and notice and cure procedures. We'll talk to Carter Walker, Vote Beat PA, about that after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, our award-winning series from 2020, when I traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border, starting in El Paso and then Ciudad Juarez for part one of The Moving Border.
CBP recibe a 10 personas hoy ingresando por la tarde. Nos quedamos en el número 19,428.
That's This Week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're speaking to Carter Walker at Vote Beat PA about some court cases in Pennsylvania regarding mail-in ballots. On Friday, the five-judge Commonwealth Court ruled that not counting a voter's mail ballot because they failed to properly date the return envelope would violate their rights under the state constitution. Republicans appealing that ruling to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. There are two other cases that are in line for possible rulings from the statewide appellate courts ahead of November's election in Pennsylvania. That could mean late in the game changes to the rules that govern vote counting in this crucial swing state. Carter, what are the other two cases? One of them involves provisional ballots. What's that one all about?
Yeah, so your listeners might know that a provisional ballot is a ballot, a just-in-case ballot that you'd fill out at the polling place if you show up there and there's something wrong with your voter registration or there's some other question about your eligibility to vote. You fill out this ballot, the County Board of Elections later after the election determines if you are eligible to vote, and then depending on that, they count or don't count your vote. This interacts with mail ballots because in a western PA county, there is a county board of elections that decided not to count the provisional ballots for mail ballot voters who had initially returned their mail ballot without that inner secrecy envelope. So the voter had just placed their ballot inside their return envelope without first putting it in a secrecy envelope, which is required under law. So the county didn't count those provisional ballots, and some of those voters, with, again, the backing from the ACLU and Public Interest Law Firm Center, sued the county, arguing that that was disenfranchising voters and misinterpreting Pennsylvania's election law. The ACLU was not successful at the county level, and so they appealed that up to the state's Commonwealth Court. This would probably impact a smaller subset. It would definitely be a smaller subset of the dating issue, but even so, it would be a small subset of ballots altogether because, you know, this would be somebody who gets disenfranchised basically twice, once on their mail ballot and once on their provisional ballot. But it could still be impactful because other counties across the state have adopted this this policy over the years. There was a similar case last year in Delaware County where the ACLU was successful, but that case didn't make it up to the Commonwealth Court, so the decision just stayed local. Now that it's at the Commonwealth Court in Butler County, it could have statewide impact.
This was brought on behalf of just two voters, is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Like I said, it usually doesn't affect that many people, but you know, they still feel it's important because these people did try to vote twice and then twice got denied.
And the in Butler County, the Court of Common Pleas judge ruled earlier this month that the case and the argument was, quote, simply not persuasive. But then the ACLU, Public Interest Law Center, as you said, appealed that decision to the Commonwealth Court. All the parties were supposed to submit the written arguments by August 23rd. So do we have an idea of the timeline of when this decision might come out?
That one was just before these new court rules on speeding things up. So it might take a little bit longer than the dating case, but I still expect the decision before too long, because that decision is also expected to get appealed up to the state Supreme Court.
And the other case that could have implications in the general election is in Washington County, Pennsylvania. That involves what happens after a voter submits a faulty mail ballot, but the dispute is actually over the county's duty to tell them about it?
That's right. This one, if I had to rank the three in terms of how many voters they would probably affect, it would probably go at the lowest, Butler, and at the highest, one we just had on Friday with the dating requirement, and then this one in Washington County right in the middle. And like you said, it deals with what duty the counties have to notify voters when their ballot is at risk of being rejected. I've explained the three reasons that a ballot might get rejected here in PA: dating, signatures, or not having a secrecy envelope. In some counties, without getting into the technical part of it too much, we use a system, an electronic system, to track our mail ballots. And when a county receives that back, they have a number of coding options that they can attach to the ballot that indicate what its disposition might be, like if it doesn't have a signature or it doesn't have a date, or they can just write ballot, the ballot has been received. And each of those codes that a county uses will generate a distinct email to a voter. Like if they use the ballot return code, it would send an email to the voter that says, hey, your ballot has been returned. If they used a code that says canceled no date, it would send a notification to the voter that, hey, your mail ballot has been canceled because you didn't write a date on it. The issue here in Washington County was that even though they were receiving these ballots back without dates or signatures or the like, they were only entering codes into the system that said that the ballot had been received. So the ACLU and the Public Interest Law Center, on behalf of some of those voters and some civil rights organizations, argued, well, that's deceptive, and it's denying the voters their due process right to challenge the decision of the county or to try and cast a provisional ballot. They argued that, well, if the voter doesn't know in the first place that their ballot's at risk of rejection, then there's no way that they can challenge that. The judge agreed with them, and now it's in the hands of the county's board of commissioners or Republican groups who have intervened to appeal that up to the state's Commonwealth Court, where it could have impact.
Did you get any comment from the state Republican Party or RNC?
No, they did not return my request for comment, and I didn't see comments from them in other stories. The county did not return my request for comment, but I did see a comment from them in the Associated Press that they hadn't made a decision about appealing. That was last Monday, and I still, as of this morning, haven't seen anyone file an appeal. So not clear whether or not that one will get appealed up to the Commonwealth Court.
So as you mentioned, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has issued an order that tightens these deadlines and speeds up election cases so that they don't affect the election calendar. But just overall, why so many cases in Pennsylvania? Is it because of the split nature of the legislature, or what's going on?
I think there's a couple of factors there, and definitely one is the legislature. You know, we have the only split legislature in the country. And you can really see the effect of that, especially when it comes to election legislation. We haven't been able to pass really anything major since 2020. There was one law that provided counties with some funding, but no changes to the rules, despite all the argument we had back and forth in 2020 about the rules. And despite many efforts, we just haven't been able to pass anything. So that means people, voters, organizations that are upset about one rule or another, they don't really have an avenue to go lobby in the legislature to get that thing changed, because it's just not happening right now. So they have turned to the courts to try and resolve these disputes. I think the other factor is just Pennsylvania is important. You know, we are the largest in terms of electoral votes. We are the largest swing state in the country, and things are very, very close this year. So there's going to be a lot of scrutiny paid to the rules as there was in 2020. And, you know, 1,000 or so ballots may not seem like a lot, but in a lot of these races, in local races and, you know, sometimes in statewide and federal races, that kind of thing can make a difference.
Absolutely. Well, we will have you back once we hear about these other cases, because they will definitely have impact this November. We're talking to Carter Walker, reporter for VoteBeat PA. That's in partnership with Spotlight PA. And VoteBeat is the nonprofit news organization committed to reporting the nuanced truth about elections and voting at a time of crisis in America. You can read Carter's excellent reporting at votebeat.org. Carter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, let's switch gears a little bit. Catskills Couture. This is Radio Chatskill.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear from a totally made-up band called the Marco Polo Adventurers, plus Exotica music on the theremin. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Emily Lee Bandry is founder of the women's accessory brand MLE, based in Ulster County and Saugerties. In fact, in the latest episode of the Cats Cast podcast, she talks about her challenges and rewards of running a fashion brand in upstate New York. Cats Cast is a biweekly series featuring Catskills culture, history, sustainability, local interviews, literature, and the arts. And it's hosted and produced by Brett Berry. And Brett Berry joins us now. Good morning, Brett.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for being here. So you regularly cover history, sustainability, culture, as we said. How did you come upon couture in the Catskills?
This was one of those ideas that came to me. The assistant for this studio reached out and said she was enjoying the podcast and wondered if we had any interest in visiting their studio in Saugerties. And so we said, yes, of course. And we went out and got a sense of what they do over there at MLE, which is kind of a, haute couture studio that specializes in sustainable accessories for women. And so I'd say it's a little outside of what we normally cover, but nothing's really outside of what we normally cover, because I think what makes Cats Cast special is that there's quite a variety of topics, as long as it's based or has to do with the Catskills.
We're going to hear your conversation and interview there and your visit to MLE studio. But were you surprised to find this ethical fashion brand right there in the Catskills in Ulster County?
Yeah, I guess I was. I think I'm surprised by a lot of things that are happening here in the Catskills that are just kind of under the radar, unless you are in that world or know about it. There's a lot of creative people here and doing some really interesting work. It's just, you know, not everyone has a storefront or is highly visible. So, you know, you have to know about it to know about it. But they're doing some amazing stuff, and their primary markets for this clothing or accessories are the big cities. New York and L.A. is mostly where they're selling to, but also picking up clients here in the Catskills, because they've opened a companion retail shop across the street, and so people are finding them here as well. But everything's manufactured right here, for the most part, using sustainable materials.
All right, let's hear your discussion with Emily Lee Mandry, founder of the ethical fashion brand MLE, based in Saugerties, New York. This is from Cat's Cast Podcast, and we'll take a listen to it now. Thanks, Brad.
Thanks, Jim.
Hi, everyone. My name is Emily Lamondry. I'm the designer of MLE. We are a women's accessories brand based in Saugerties, New York, in the Catskills. And we are in our studio today, which is on Partition Street. It's in 32 Partition. It's a co-working space, a renovated church that they turned into different office spaces. And we have our production space in here. So we have a huge cutting table. We have a jewelry bench. We have a lot of industrial sewing machines. I'm here today with my studio assistant, Kiana, who's helping me.
What's your history with design and fashion?
So I previously had a fashion line right out of college. It started out as a silkscreen t-shirt line and then morphed into a women's ready-to-wear line that I was doing wholesale for Urban Outfitters. But before that, I mean, I'd always been interested in the visual arts. I had a background in painting, fine arts, and I'm coming from a long line in terms of my family, different generations of creatives, seamstresses, tailors, jewelry makers.
From Italy.
From Italy and Armenia, yeah. So my grandparents were both tailors and seamstresses, and I learned a lot of my sewing from my grandmother. She wouldn't let me use her industrial machine, but I got to watch what she was doing, and I learned from her that way. My uncles on my mom's side, my Armenian uncles, were stone setters in the garment district when they came here from Iran. And I have some jewelry that I inherited from them, and that's been a big inspiration for me as well.
Terms like fast fashion and eco-consciousness would have been foreign to Emily's relatives when they worked in this business, but the apparel industry today is notoriously wasteful, pumping out a nonstop flow of cheap, throwaway clothing at a tremendous cost to the environment and to the health and well-being of garment industry workers in developing nations. Assistant Kiana Dugenhaus studied sustainable costume design as a theater student at SUNY New Paltz. And so, fresh out of college, I asked if she could give an overview of the subject.
Well, the short answer is that there are people who make it their whole career to talk about sustainability in fashion. So there's a lot. There is a lot going on there, but we all wear clothes. So you can think that you sort of don't care about fashion, but it does affect everyone's life. How clothing is made, how it's marketed to us, all of that affects our day-to-day life. Over the years, it has become increasingly common to buy your clothing in like really mass-produced ways and to be very removed from the production process of what you're wearing. Prices are going down, and to bring those prices down, companies are cutting costs in the materials that they're using, in underpaying their workers. So that leads to processes that are not as good for the environment, not as good for the local community where the thing is being made, where the thing is being sold.
These college years, but an experience in her early career turned out to be a revelation and an inspiration for a new way of thinking about and producing clothing.
What's interesting, I guess, about doing this whole thing is sustainability wasn't really talked about when I was in school and creating things. I mean, I started to experience it just firsthand when I was doing production, when I was silkscreen t-shirts for my line, or I was doing women's ready-to-wear. I remember I had to order hundreds of yards of fabric that were custom made as a print I had designed. The fabric came, we cut all the fabric out at the factory, and then there were scraps, which I had never witnessed this before. And then I was wondering, what do they do with the scraps? They throw them out. All those scraps get thrown out. And just thinking about, I'm just this one small company back then, had this one order, you know, for the Urban Outfitters for like 200 or so pieces, and I'm feeling guilty about my scraps. What about every other fashion company, and what are they doing with their scraps? And then, you know, I just started to think about it more as my business was growing. And especially with clothing, you worry about sizing and fit issues. And that's the number one reason for returns. That, to me, influenced why I decided to do accessories in terms of I knew I wanted to do something in fashion, but a more sustainable option for me was accessories because I didn't have to worry as much about sizing and I didn't have to worry about having bloated inventory, you know, all different sizing, and then worry about how it's going to fit on the customer. And then thinking about when you're doing production runs now, like our scraps, I just had a conversation with Kiana. We cut out this one little piece for a bag and we had a handful of scraps. And I said, do we throw these scraps out? And we decided, no, we're going to put them in this box. So we keep all our scraps. We don't even throw anything out, you know, and that's something, again, we're like the size of our company versus other companies or fast fashion brands. What are they doing with their scraps? So the materials we're using, it's a lot of upcycled materials, eco-friendly materials, recycled materials, all the fabrics we source from the garment district. So they're leftover fabric from other designers from their production runs. All the jewelry we make, we are using recycled metals. So that means the casting companies we work with, they actually melt down scraps and we use those scraps to make our pieces. And besides that, we're also making hair clips overseas, and we use cellulose acetate for that. So that's a plant-based material that's laser cut and hand-shaped. And what I love about that material is it's a more eco-friendly alternative to the typical petroleum-based plastic. When you acquire something, thinking about that role it's going to play in your life and the idea of you're acquiring it for the long term, it's not something you're quickly going to discard. So thinking about investing in, you know, a piece that is high quality, well made, designed to last, thinking about what the impact is on the environment by you purchasing that. And by environment doesn't necessarily have to mean planet Earth. It can also mean who is being hired, who is, you know, being paid to make these pieces for you. Is it just socially, is it a responsible decision? It's very complicated nowadays when you're buying something, thinking about who made this, were they paid fairly? Is this piece I'm buying, is this going to last, or am I going to wash it once, it's going to fall apart? And then is it more work for me to take care of versus like knowing upfront this is a high quality piece and it's going to last my rest of my life?
I asked Emily if she could illustrate that point through a single product, say a handbag.
Just with handbags, thinking about the hardware that goes into a handbag. So usually the hardware can be the most expensive part of a handbag. So zippers are very expensive. And that tends to be in terms of fast fashion where brands cut corners. So if you're having a problem with the zipper, as soon as you get this item, I mean, that's a clear sign that this is not well made. Also, what's going on inside the bag? So a lot of linings and interfacings, things that are put in there to reinforce the bag, especially in areas where it's going to be stressed, areas where like a clasp is being closed or a closure is snapping, to make sure that this piece is going to last a long time. And that's not necessarily something you can see, but I can guarantee you that these fast fashion brands are not putting that kind of care into the structure of what this handbag is. And just the fabric, you know, a lot of fast fashion, it's designed to be worn, you know, a handful of times and then it literally falls apart. The fabric gets runs in it. I mean, a lot of fabric nowadays for fast fashion, they're using rayon, which sounds like a good idea, but rayon is very problematic in terms of the care. When you wash it, it shrinks. It's very fragile. You rub against it and the fibers just, you know, become puffy and stick out from the fabric. So it's a huge headache. It might look beautiful and shiny and flat when you're first looking at it, but then the more you work with this material, it's just, you know, it's so anytime I see rayon, I just am like, stay away. So that's handbags. In terms of jewelry, I mean, fast fashion jewelry tends to be a base metal, and base metal means a non-precious metal. Like usually it's a brass or even a zinc. Sometimes it could just be an amalgam of something that, you know, we don't even know what it is, but probably has lead in it or other things in it, nickel, things that cause allergic reactions that you wouldn't really know unless you put it on. A lot of these fast fashion brands, it's not even labeled if it's hypoallergenic or not. You just buy it for the look. And again, you wear it once or twice. So it's like, okay, my ears are getting red and irritated, but whatever, the earring has already corroded. I'm throwing it out, you know? So our pieces, we make sure that they're all hypoallergenic. They don't have any nickel in them, any lead in them. We're making sure that if we're using a base metal like brass, we're doing a very thick layer of plating on top in 14 karat gold or platinum, like a real precious metal, to make sure that piece lasts. And a lot of times with fast fashion, they're just doing this quick dip so you get the color, the tone, but it's going to come off really quickly.
Who, like, if you could characterize your clientele, who is that woman?
Yes, so she is someone that is sophisticated, elegant. She's a world traveler. She likes dressing up. She likes going to brunch. She is a chic, fabulous woman. Our pieces, we say statement accessories for the modern gentlewoman. It's the idea of it's someone that's elevated, elegant, but she's not afraid to make a statement. She likes our pieces because they are unique, they're a bit whimsical, but it's also something you can still wear every day to upgrade your look.
And I would imagine that because you're using scraps and things that cast-offs from other larger runs, that what you're making is limited. And when you run out, it moves into a different fabric or a different color if you can't rely on custom product.
Yeah, so that happens all the time. We create a bag or a scrunchie or a sleep mask, and it's a certain style, and then it becomes a top seller, but then you realize, oh, I can't source that fabric anymore, and they have to come up with another iteration. I mean, it forces you to keep innovating, which is cool, but then at the same time, it is a bit difficult and can be challenging, especially when you find something that becomes very popular and has high demand.
I asked Emily Lamondry how she came to settle in the Catskills and what it's been like to develop her brand here.
I had been coming upstate on the weekends with my husband when we were living in the city. We were living in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and we were in an apartment that didn't have any outdoor area. We were right above a bar that basically every time you opened your window, cigarette smoke would come in. We heard the subway every 7 minutes. The whole apartment would shake. So it's getting to the point where we were just craving outdoor space, craving just to have our own space. And the house that we ended up in Saugerties, actually, we just picked it because it was so remote and secluded. You couldn't even see your neighbors from the street. It was just very peaceful, completely different experience from what we were going through in the city. And it wasn't until after we bought our house, moved in, that we actually saw what the downtown area was like. And we were very pleased to see that there was this really cute village. You know, we have a movie theater. We have really amazing shops. I now have a shop in Saugerties on Main Street, which has been awesome. So it worked out really well for us. When I launched my brand, I launched it with Instagram ads because that was my background going into it. And we were targeting women between the ages of 18 to 44 in metropolitan areas across the U.S. So that being said, I have a big following in New York City, but I also have a big following on the West Coast, in L.A. especially. And it's been interesting now operating in Saugerties because while the majority of my customers are all over the U.S., I am starting to build a following here in Saugerties, which is really exciting. I've done a few local markets like Field and Supply in Kingston. And what's been exciting about that is that the people I meet there, they connect with the brand and they reach back out. I've had multiple customers email me afterwards that they want to order something else or they've come into the store. So it does feel like I am building a base here. And the new store that I just opened on Main Street in Saugerties, I've partnered with another brand called Chambers Vintage. And Kim, the owner of Chambers Vintage, has a very big local following. So that's been really amazing to be able to partner with her and expand the local awareness for my brand. It is interesting having a fashion brand in upstate New York, especially, you know, the contrast between, you know, living essentially in the forest and then having the space in the village, which I'm very grateful for, to have that balance of, you know, that space to just take a breath and relax and step back and just reflect and meditate on things, and then being able to have a space to work. I mean, that's something in this, when I lived in the city, I didn't have that kind of space available. And you need a lot of space when you're doing, especially when you're doing production, to really spread out. And I mean, in terms of, you know, finding a team up here, it has been a bit difficult. But the thing is, there are very talented creatives here. We're all just in the woods, and it just takes time, you know, meeting each other, finding out who's here to connect. And there are, again, so many talented, amazing people up here that are willing, you know, to work with you and to work hard and believe in your vision. And that's been really cool to find them.
And that is an excerpt of Brett Berry's Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, biweekly series featuring Catskills culture, history, sustainability, local interviews, literature, and the arts. Brett produces it at Silver Hollow Audio in the heart of the Catskills, and they've been voted best regional podcast for 3 years in a row. Congrats to you guys. And more information at catscast.com. That's KAATSCAST.com. We'll take a break. When we come back, learn more about Zane Grey Plein Air's two events coming up this month. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, host of On Point. Each hour of On Point is a journey to help make complicated issues understandable. Every issue brings more questions, like how did we get here? Why is this happening? And what does it mean? And how do we fix it? So let's figure this out and make sense of the world together. Join me weekday mornings at 11 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Zane Grey Plein Air offers seasonally inspired art events and workshops in sync with upstate living in the Upper Delaware and the Catskills. They've got two events coming up on September 14th, So Falls Skinner Falls and Paint the Big Eddie. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Karen Menigan about it.
Good morning, Karen, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Hi, good morning, Valerie.
Good. So you are here to speak with us about Zane Grey in Plein Air. Tell us about the organization.
We're really happy to be back with you to talk about our events for September. We're on the cusp approaching the end of an exhibition that we held a plein air event at Milton Skinner House. It was a return event in June, and all of our painters and photographers, and we actually had one plein air kid contribute works they did that day. And they've been on view in our gallery annex, which is at Narrowsburg Union. We have a main gallery, and then we have an additional exhibition space where all of these works will remain on view through September 14th. It's really wonderful because there are a lot of painters painting one another at the Skinner's Falls Bridge. A lot of them incorporate some of the architecture at the Milton Skinner former home and barn. So it's chock full of imagery of the Upper Delaware River, which has been really a mainstay in a lot of our programming over the past 6 years. The plein air events.
And what other events have you had this season?
Well, let's see. Actually, I've taught a couple of interesting workshops. The one most recently was at the Tustin Community Heritage, Tustin Heritage Community Garden, sorry. And I taught a flower portrait sketch workshop in the garden, a two-day workshop at the Old Stone House of Hasbrook. That was a landscape sketch workshop. It was.
How many workshops a season do you have? And do you have any upcoming over the fall, winter, and spring?
Well, an interesting thing for me and for our group in the 6 years that I've been running events, some years I've had a dozen to 14 workshops, to be honest. We went from two our first year and kind of rocketed our way to over a dozen in a season. And we, in that time period, of course, when COVID arrived, we pivoted to hosting hybrid events with guest artist panels and I'll call it hybrid workshops where people would work at home and with us online. With the advent now in this past year of adding my gallery, I have workshop space indoors. So I've added indoor and outdoor programming. So I've actually added to the mix.
Wonderful. Wonderful. You have a show up now called So Falls, Skinner's Falls. And that yes. is on view at the Narrowsburg Union in Narrowsburg, yes, New York. Mm-hmm. And are those paintings and photographs up for sale?
Yes, they are for sale. We also have an online gallery.
Yes.
If you can't make it to Narrowsburg, you could view the entire exhibition there. And you could also purchase from our website.
Okay.
You know, we'd love to have folks come in, obviously, to Narrowsburg. But for those who can't, we have a presence in our online gallery.
And what is the website that folks would have?
Okay, our website is zanegrayplenair.com. Anyone visiting there, it's a great way to sign up for announcements. For our events, there's a calendar of events there, kind of a one-stop experience for beautiful artwork.
On September 14th, you will also be having an event at the Big Eddy in Narrowsburg.
Yes, it's called Paint the Big Eddy, but it'll be painting Narrowsburg at large.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, we'd love to see everyone come out. You know, September 14th is a big day. We will be having more events indoors throughout the late fall and winter season.
And give us that website again.
Zane Gray Plein, P-L-E-I-N, Air,
okay.
A-I-R.com.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you so much for doing what you do with your organization.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi for that report. Before we go, I want to remind you about the Radio Catskill 2024 Community Awards. It's coming up next week, Thursday, September 12th at La Sagone in Narrowsburg. We're honoring folks and or individuals and organizations and their outstanding local contributions to environmental stewardship and sustainability. Catskill Mountain Keeper, Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, Delaware Highlands Conservancy, Farm Arts Collective, Seeds of Northeastern Pennsylvania, and two special recognitions for folks who may not get as much recognition as they deserve. Lori Ramey from the Upper Delaware Council and Lisa Lyons of Morgan Outdoors. You can join us and help honor them at the event, the Radio Catskill 2024 Community Awards, September 12th. Ticket information at wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Join Radio Catskill for our annual community award, September 12th, honoring local organizations and individuals dedicated to environmental stewardship and sustainability. Catskill Mountain Keeper, Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, Delaware Highlands Conservancy, Farm Arts Collective, and Seeds of Northeastern Pennsylvania. Help us celebrate their commitment to the environment at the 2024 Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 12th at La Sagone, Narrowsburg. Tickets at wjffradio.org.
Hi, I'm Bill Williams. Join me for the Kingfisher Project tonight, when my guest will be Bob Lindsay, a lifelong recovery advocate whose work has benefited thousands of his fellow New Yorkers.
Addiction affects all of us, directly or indirectly, and as a result, we all bear some responsibility to do something about it.
That's the Kingfisher Project on the Local Edition, tonight at 6, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Today's forecast, sunny, gorgeous outside, high 70. Tonight, clear with some areas of late night fog, a low of 47. Some of that fog lingering tomorrow morning. Sunny and high 73 tomorrow. Looking ahead, some showers Friday evening through late Saturday night. On Point's next. It's 11 o'clock.